You're listening to episode 74 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Chang.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Chang, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
Hey, what's up, Storyteller Tribe? If you're looking for an intimate community for storytellers where you can check in about your writing and hang out with fellow writers, or if you'd like to submit questions for future guests on our show, along with sneak peeks of future episodes, join me over in our Facebook group at facebook.com/group/88cupsoftea. There's a lot of love and support and encouragement going on in this special community of ours, and I can't wait to meet you in there. Before we head right into introductions, I wanted to thank Vermont College of Fine Arts for sponsoring today's episode. They're the first low residency MFA program in the nation to focus exclusively on writing for young readers. At the end of the show, you'll find out why they're ranked one of the best low residency writing programs in the country. I'm thrilled to have Justina Ireland on the show today. Justina is the author of Vengeance Bound and Promise of Shadows, and she has two books coming out next year called Dread Nation and The Never and The Now. In today's episode, we dive right into why it's crucial for us to grow and change as people and why it's worthwhile to say the things that are most important to us and to share it with others so they know they're not alone. We talk about writer's burnout and why it's important to find what works for you and your process, and I'm really looking forward for you all to hear our conversation about handling the overwhelm of the political climate and Justina's advice on powerful and productive ways of decompressing. Now more than ever, we need more diversity in books and the media, and I'm really excited for you to listen in on the important steps to take to write diverse characters that break away from institutional stereotypes. We also discuss how to approach difficult scenes that are closest to our own feelings or experiences, and we unpack why it's difficult to get through them in the first place and how to conquer those scenes. Now let's jump right in. Hey everyone! We have Justina Ireland with us today. Justina, how are you? We are so excited to have you here.
Oh, I'm so excited to be here.
Listeners were very excited to have you on the show. They're probably freaking out right now. We're all very grateful to have you on. I would love to kick it off and ask you how you first fell in love with writing.
I was not one of those kids who wrote stories in school. I loved reading. I was really, really a huge reader. I would try to write short stories, but I would never finish anything. I was more focused on science fiction and fantasy. I loved how science fiction and fantasy can take a really difficult topic that we have trouble talking about in a real world setting and do it pretty effortlessly. And if you look at classics like The Handmaid's Tale and Brave New World in 1984, these are very big ideas that authors are dissecting. They do it while also entertaining. And I always thought that was amazing. As I got older, I found it harder and harder to find the books I wanted to read. That's when I actually started thinking about writing. It always seems like a bit of an egotistical thing to say, I'm going to write the books I want to read. Writing and creating stories is an act of ego. You have to think that your words are worth saying and worth people reading to actually write. I always loved science fiction and fantasy. And so when it came time to write, those were obviously the areas I wanted to delve into. I also love reading romance. I'm terrible at writing romance. My idea of romance is, and then he bought her a hamburger and it was the most romantic thing ever.
That's totally up my alley.
I was like, I just want someone to feed me. I tend to write more science fiction and fantasy because I do like that what if question. What if space travel was like a thing everybody did? But what if only certain people got to do space travel? How would that change the landscape? What if it was tied to culture, or what if it was tied to class? How would that make the world look? That's why science fiction and fantasy are so much fun to write, because it's a lot of answering these what if questions.
Do you remember one author that did blow your mind and you're like, wow, this is beautiful. This is work of art.
My favorite author when I was a young adult, and I know everyone's like, young adult fiction didn't exist when I was a kid. Well, young adult fiction existed when I was a kid. They just didn't call it young adult. They just called it teen books or whatever. Yeah. But Christopher Pike.
Is this a guy who wrote the vampire stories?
Yes.
Yes. Terrible vampire stories. Oh my God, I remember reading
those first ones. Remember Me and Give Me a Kiss were all these books about murder. High school was full of murder. And I was like, this is amazing. There's one called Weekend. There's one called Slumber Party. And like the one about Slumber Party, this slumber party happens when they're kids. And this one girl's sister is set on fire. And then she comes back and tries to kill them when they're in high school. The premises are so far-fetched. reason I liked them is because they didn't flinch. The story always went to someone actually getting murdered. Whereas with R.L. Stine and Fear Street, a lot of times those books were scary, but no one died. The person you thought was dead, it ends up coming back by the end of the third act, and you realize they're alive the whole time. But Christopher Pike would murder fools. He was like a murderous.
He was like a slasher. He just went left and right with that
stuff. Everyone dies. And I thought that was awesome.
You just gave me a massive flashback. Yes, that is a really good point. He actually was willing to take that step and push buttons and push that boundary at that time because everything was so shielded.
There's the one book, and I can't remember the title of it, where they're stuck in this town and then they start to tell these different stories. It's just this really weird book, but the main character dies at the end. And so you're reading this book and then you're like, wait, what? She's dead? How do you kill the main character? I would not write his books because that's a lot of murder to keep up. Yeah. It's hard to keep up that much tension throughout the story. But his books blew my mind as a kid because I was just like, how can you do this?
I love the way you approached that and the way you saw that. Wow, you just made me see Christopher Pike's work in a completely different way.
Yeah, but those vampire books are garbage, though. Don't read those. The vampire books are probably
okay,
the worst.
I like the vampire books. I am that kid in the corner who's always creeping on all the vampire books. Bite me anytime. What about right now? There's a lot more authors, thankfully, that are being more aware about quality in terms of not being lazy, really touching on topics that could be seen as very difficult by most people. Are there any authors out there right now that you do admire, that you do respect, that you do highly encourage listeners to take a peek at, to study, so that they can understand and break out of certain bubbled spheres?
Oh yeah, most definitely. N.K. Jemisin's fantasy is just flawless. Her world building is so amazing and so in-depth. Her 100,000 Kingdoms trilogy, which is her first trilogy, is some of my favorite fantasy books. Kate Elliott, her Cold Magic trilogy is really great. She does a great job of blending cultures. She's good at upending stereotypes and looking at what people are going to think and subverting it on the page as well. Sylvia Moreno Garcia, she writes vampire books.
Amazing.
Yes, there you go. The book Certain Dark Things has Mexican vampires, which is really, really cool. It's not the same old European-based vampires. There's a lot of authors doing really exciting and amazing things. It's great because I think when you do start getting out of that bubble and out of those same story forms that we've used over and over again for going on the full 100 years of publishing, what you see is really exciting and new stories that come up to light. Sometimes taking those risks, you fail because that's what risk is about, right? You either succeed or you fail. But I think a lot of authors are breaking down those barriers. I love Daniel Jose Older's Shadow Shaper, which is a YA book. He basically takes urban fantasy story and actually puts it in a city, which a lot of times if you read urban fantasy, it's like a white lady who's got some sort of power or something running through a city. There's like no people of color. And I'm like, how are you in the city? There's nobody that doesn't look like you. Which is like the opposite of every city I've ever been to. Daniel Hale did this great job of showing that cross-cultural landscape and that cross-pollinization of cultures that happen in a city. And I think his second book, I think, comes out maybe later this year. But the first one, Shadow Shaper, it's a great YA book. It reads fast. It's got a lot of attention. There's kissing. So like everyone loves kissing. I think a lot of people are doing a lot of great things. And I think it's just unfortunate that a lot of times those authors aren't getting necessarily the marketing push or the attention that some of these other authors who are doing the same thing over and over again aren't getting. I'm at the point now where I have so many authors that I just auto buy their books and I just have a shelf. I'm like, when I'm in a bad mood, I'm going to come and read your book because I know it's going to be awesome.
And that's the biggest compliment for them. I hope you tell them that. If I was one of them, I'd be like, what? I am so flattered. Are you kidding? I'd love for listeners to hear and to learn about what's exciting you most in your work right now.
I have two books that I'm working on that come out in 2018. First is Dread Nation, and that is post-Civil War restoration era zombies, undead. So Civil War, Battle of Gettysburg happens, you know, in the middle of the Civil War, and all the dead rise and start walking. And then it becomes this whole different shift to fight the undead instead of fighting each other.
That's so cool.
But then that really changes the political landscape. You have this indentured servitude of young Black men and women who are trained to fight these undead because the upper classes, which are predominantly white, are not going to fight them themselves. I wrote, started writing that book 3 years ago. And now the parallels I see today, like our political climate and things that are happening within society, are so strong. It's almost too real. And I love that. I love it when you come up with some like really wacky idea and then all of a sudden the parallels are there and you're like, yes, now I look like I'm brilliant. Zombie books are never really about the zombies. They're always about how people react, how society comes together, and how groups of people react to this threat that's not human. people will come out and they will hate that book, but I will still love that book because that is the book of my heart. And then I'm working on another book, is on the adult side of science fiction. It's about a group of cyborgs. It's kind of like Battlestar Galactica meets 12 Years a Slave, which is like a weird comparison, but it's really about this group of cyborgs looking at their history and what it means to be part of a diaspora, fighting for their rights as individuals because they're considered property and they're considered not human. That one is a book I wrote and I was like, that's a great book. And then it was acquired and now I'm going back and revising it. And I'm like, this is a terrible book.
Well, first off, congrats on it being acquired. That's amazing.
Thanks. It's just a cycle of writing, right? Like you write something, like it's brilliant. And you come back, you're like, what is wrong with me?
Yes, it's art. Artists feel this. My grandpa's an artist and he goes through that all the time. I have different mediums and forms of storytelling that I consider as art, whether it's podcasting, writing, acting. You always end up going back and saying, oh, crap, I could have done a better job. Specifically, there's this one episode talking about this real time right now. I was supposed to release this past Thursday, and it's a welcome back episode for this year, for 2017, and it's a really different one. It's a narrative version where I interviewed my grandpa about his life and the discrimination he had to face in Malaysia trying to make it as an artist when art also didn't even exist at the time. I just felt so much freaking pressure, like you, I'm sure. Now it's acquired and it's, oh my God. And then now I'm like, holy crap, I announced that it was going to be available February 2nd. I went through it with my girlfriend. We're like, oh God, we need a few days for this. This is when I have to choose to sacrifice pushing myself or making it on time, or is it I'm going to end up doing a disservice to my grandpa and not really fully honoring his story. So I ended up choosing to take a few more days. At least I have that luxury. For you, I'm sure you have a deadline where it's like, oh my God, I can't even imagine being in your shoes. I get where you're coming from. So what do you do in those circumstances when you are going through so much back and forth? Do you talk to somebody? Is it your editor or your agent or your husband? Or do you listen to your gut? When do you know when to stop?
What I like to do is I like to talk myself through what's the worst thing people will say about this. I don't usually vent about writing to my husband or my agent or editor or anybody. It's my work, right? And until I give it to them for them to comment on, it's my work. Sometimes I like to look at it and I'm like, what is the worst thing that anybody can say about this? And then I let that play in my head and I'm like, okay, but then what? It's that whole what if. And it's usually not that bad, right? Like, what's the worst thing somebody's going to do? They're going to trash it on Goodreads. They're going to
they're gonna knock on your door and be like, how dare you?
Yeah, no one's going to show up at my door like, chapter 23 was the worst chapter I've read in my life. That's really where it comes down to. It's like, what's the worst thing that happens?
No one's going to pull a Christopher Pike on you.
Right. No one's going to try to murder me. Right. I'm not going to end up in a Christopher Pike novel. At the end of the day, it's like, why am I upset about it? And it's not the criticism that I'm afraid of. It's the fact that I don't think I did as well as I could. And then it puts me in a different headspace instead of just saying, oh my God, this is terrible. Okay, why do I think this is terrible? Well, this character's arc isn't as developed as I want. Okay, how do I fix that? And then I go back and I can fix it. It just takes me a little longer to get the stuff on the page instead of just sitting down and like, I love everything, words are amazing, and typing out all those words. I have to kind of sit there with myself and my thoughts and get through that into the, okay, this is awful, but I can fix it, I can do this. I think a lot of people, especially when they start out writing, they don't know how to get to that point of, yes, this is awful, but that's okay because I can fix this, I can do this. The more you write and the more you are able to go through and fix it and actually make the changes that you want to make. Nobody writes a story that is awesome in their head. When it's in your head, it's the perfect story that's ever been thought of. And then you try to vomit it onto the page and it gets all mean.
It's an apocalypse.
It's a train wreck. You're like, this is awful. Knowing you can go back and fix that and try to clean it up to something not as terrible as when you first started. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just, you just have to get your head there to just talk yourself through that.
So I'm taking from that you don't have critique partners or workshops that you love, because I know there's a lot of writers who love that community of being able to show their work. And even in times where they are facing some doubts and some difficulties, they can go to them. So are you more of a person who likes to work on your own and be in your own space?
I am. I do have folks who read for me. Tessa Grattan has read my stuff. And then there's a group of Black science fiction and fantasy authors. We have like private back channel and we share work across there too. So I've shared work with them as well. I don't like to share work until it's to a certain level of completeness. So I've never been a big fan of query groups or even workshops. I'm at the last hall of an MFA program. And going to workshops is not my favorite thing because I don't like showing unfinished work because you show that first chapter and they're like, this is amazing. And I'm like, it's the first chapter. You can go downhill quickly. I'd rather have the whole piece of work because it's going to go off the rails. Some point in every draft, your story is going to go off the rails and you got to figure out how to bring it back. I don't like showing work before it's too soon. You know, a lot of people are not like that. Some people are like, I like to change a chapter and send another chapter and then another chapter and me and my friend work back and forth. But I've always found that kind of ruins the specialness of the idea.
The magic.
Yeah. that, because then people have expectations of what's going to happen next. And then when it doesn't happen next, they're like, oh, I didn't really think this is a good second next chapter. I keep my work to myself until like a good level of doneness. For me, I try to write something every day. It's not necessarily, it might not be fiction. It might be something else. It might be like a blog post, or it might be something nonfiction, or, you know, it might be work for hire kind of stuff. But just because I like getting the words out, and if I write every day, I think it's easier for me when I do have to sit in front of the screen. But I also think there's something to be said for giving yourself that space from a story and writing when it feels right. Because I think a lot of people force themselves to write every day and then they burn out and then they never ever want to write again. So I think it's important to figure out what works for you and what works for your process.
How is your process? I'm sure it's different with every book, but do you have a schedule?
That's funny you say that. I write work for hire, and then also I write my own book. So I have a couple little scary chapter books coming out later this year from Capstone. That's work for hire. So basically they give me the story, the breakdown of what they want to happen, and then I just kind of go in and I write it. And then my own stuff, I get to come up with the ideas. If they're terrible or great, it's all on me. But I get up in the morning and I write. I write before I go to work, before my day gets started. I usually get up around 4:30. I either go run on the treadmill or I write. And most days, if I have something to do, I write. And then I try to fit the treadmill in later. So, I mean, we all have our priorities. Some people are like, you should work out every day. I'm like, you should. But I'm not going to, because I'm going to work out when I feel like it.
Holy moly, you wake up at 4:30. What time do you usually sleep?
I usually go to bed by 9. I have a daughter and she goes to bed about 8:30. So once she's tucked in, it gives me like just enough time to kind of decompress. And then I'm in bed by 9. I am not a night owl, which is fortunate, because every time I go to the conference and people are like, let's go get a drink. I'm like, okay, but it's 8:45. I don't know if it's 15 minutes is enough time to have an alcoholic beverage. I need to be in bed soon.
Less of a reason to have to hit the treadmill since you skipped out on the drinks. You have a lot to churn out then. I feel like I would probably be one of those who would feel burnt out if I would be work for hire for writing and then writing my own stuff. I think I would really stay away because it's just so much. How are you able to do that? Do you don't ever run into a block?
Of course I do. Everyone does. And then I go play Pokemon and then I'm good. I freaking love Pokemon, dude. I've been playing the Pokemon Sun nonstop. And then once you beat the game, there's all kinds of stuff to do after the game.
Wait, so you're not doing Pokemon Go?
No, I didn't do Pokemon Go. My phone, it was weird.
I think it takes a lot of space, right? Because I know my girlfriend had it before for a little bit. And I think for me, I didn't want to because I was scared, because I know I get addicted easily. And I don't need a Pokemon Go on top of my plate right now. I just can't, because my life is going to be over. It's just going to be bad.
No, I'm on the DS. So it's like I sit there. And also because I am not good at walking, I'm like really clumsy. So if I was like walking on my phone trying to catch Pokemon, I would get hit by a car.
Oh my God, knock on wood.
So I was like, I'm going to go ahead and just say no to that. And then when the Pokemon game came out in November, I've been like playing it ever since. But so like there's some mornings where I'm just like, this isn't going to happen. And I'll just play Pokemon for an hour and then get my kid up for school.
I love that you're playing when she's sleeping, but you're not playing with her, which I think is so cute.
No, she has her own Pokemon.
That's amazing that you wake up at 4:30, you have a full day, and you still sound like you have time for your daughter and you tuck her in, you're spending story time with her. It's beautiful. It's crazy how, as a kid, how much you are affected for the rest of your life, how you're raised with or without the presence of your parents. Your daughter's lucky. And to also have a mom that's an artist. And I just think that's so profound to have someone in your life that can guide you in that aspect. I really admire your Twitter presence. You're amazing for voicing out what you truly feel and talking about authenticity and people being genuine. That's you. One of our listeners, she's lovely. Her name is Tia Bearden. She says that she loves your Twitter presence as well. And she loves your Friday jokes and puns. And she's really appreciative because of how much you interact with people, especially you never shy away from tackling hard issues. Tia knows that actually ends up taking a toll. It would take a toll on anyone. I mean, I'm feeling it now with all this stuff with the presidential elections and what he's capable of doing in just 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. She wants to know, and for a broader scope, I agree with Tia's question. I'd love to know too, is how do you decompress from all of this?
First of all, I think it's really easy to say things on Twitter. It's really easy to either be a complete and utter asshole or to be completely vapid and talk about nothing but happy book birthday or whatever it is, or whatever you're eating, take a picture of your food. So it's really easy on social media to have an opinion. And the fact that so many people don't, I do find kind of disappointing, because that's your one chance to say something. You're never going to have that chance to speak to that many people about important things as you will on social media, especially Twitter, because Twitter travels so very quickly. Like Tumblr, you can say something on it and like it'll get like maybe reblogged a few hundred times unless it's something really quirky, and then it gets thousands and thousands of posts. If you're not saying anything worthwhile, then why put out the effort and the time, right? It's the same thing with writing. If you're going to write, why not put out the best writing you can. Why not say something worthwhile? But for me, the way I keep going is as I just think of the things I love. There's so much about this world I love, and there's so many things that are terrible, but there's so many things that are absolutely great. Like Pokemon. Like, I really genuinely love Pokemon, and people think it's fun. Yeah, I know, like, you're laughing. Like,
I'm laughing because I love Pokemon too.
Right. It's like the whole idea that you walk around and you catch these little creatures, and then you nurture them and grow them in these bigger creatures, and then make them fight other people's creatures. It's this really cool and weird idea. Be able to love something without any fear of judgment is what I think really people are afraid of. To say, I love this country, but I see how it can be better, and to comment on how it can be better, even though people don't want to hear it. For a lot of people, they fear that pushback. But when you realize it doesn't matter, it really doesn't matter what Jane from Toledo thinks, right? Because you're not in the same room as Jane, and you're probably never going to meet Jane. And you can always just block Jane, and then Jane doesn't exist. It's worthwhile to say the things that are important to you and put those out there, because it gives other people a chance to realize that they're not alone. My first book came out, I was told by a lot of veteran YA authors, you can't talk about politics on Twitter. You can't criticize people. You'll just never succeed. You'll never go anywhere in this industry. And I was like, that's kind of bullshit, right? Yep. Like, that's not how any other industry works. I mean, every industry, especially with art, is all about critique. It's all about looking at the art that's out there and saying, hey, this is why this is good art. Hey, this is why this art falls short of what the artist should have wanted for their art. Especially in the YA and the kid lit community, we're so focused on being nice and not being rude to anyone that it forces us to either stifle our own opinions and not have an opinion. But to me, the nicest thing you can do to someone is give them a chance to have their opinion and own it, to interact with that opinion and say, well, you know, I understand why you're saying this, but here's some things where I think it's wrong, or, you know, this is where my opinion is coming from, and this is why I'm coming from this space. It seems like I'm on Twitter all the time because it's just because I go on and I'm on for like 10 minutes and I say a bunch of stuff and then I'm off and then I come back like maybe a couple hours later. And at that time, it's just getting reblogged and other people are seeing it or interacting and stuff like that. And I feel like Twitter is not just a conversation, because I don't think it's necessarily a conversation, but I do think it's a chance to understand that you're not alone in the world,
absolutely,
which is a completely different way. Yeah, like, I'm not going to go and argue with you. If you tell me you're like, well, the Muslim ban is a great idea, I'm literally not going to argue with you, because that's the stupidest opinion I've ever heard. I'm not even going to try. However, if you're like, I don't understand why this is such a bad thing, I am more than happy to explain to you how the Constitution works. That's a completely different. And I think for a lot of things, it's really important, especially now, to know that you're not alone, that there are other people who are also very upset about things, other people who are like, this is not who we are. And to be able to reach out and find those people when you're hurting. A lot of people are like, Twitter is very draining. It's upsetting. Everyone's always fighting. But for me, Twitter invigorates me because it makes me realize there are other people who want to fight for the same things I'm fighting for. And it's awesome to know that you're not alone.
I love that you do create that space for education, even though I know there's people out there who are just
there's
like,
some people you just can't help.
Oh, like, can I give you an example of what just happened to me? I was on such a high from such an incredible experience at the Women's March in downtown LA. Mm-hmm. And I posted photos on my Facebook page for the podcast. And there's this random girl, no idea who she is, just strolls right up and posts over there and says, oh, marching for the right to kill babies. I was like, you know, I don't want to even bother with her. But then at the same time, I'm like, you know what? I took 14 hours, no joke, to calm down and to think about my response. It'll be really easy for me to lash back. But at the same time, this is not my personal page. This is a page where anyone has access to. So let me allow this to be a space, a platform where other people who think like her, but aren't as aggressive to attack, but that's their world where they really genuinely believe it's like marching to kill babies. I would like for those quiet readers to then see this space as a form of education. So I ended up explaining this whole thing in the end. I was just like, you know what? Just so you understand the value of marches, you even being able to make opinions, to vote in all of this was because thousands of women before you were even born already marched for you to even have the right to say what you're going to say right now, for you to go about and put your vote in who you want. So just remember that before you go and attack people, that there are still women who are going to march, and I'm still going to march, and I'm also going to march for you, for your rights. And she had nothing to say. The thing I appreciate about you is that you can respond so quickly.
I've seen it all though. Like, I've just seen all the responses and all the snarky comments. And I'm like, oh, yeah, here's the person saying that we're playing the race card. Cool. Glad you showed up on time. Let me go ahead and mark down my bingo card. I think at a certain point, you just know what the responses are going to be to anything you say, and you can predict them. And then you just nod or cool story, bro. And like, you know, move on. Most of the people who have those very regressive, conservative viewpoints, they're getting their talking points from the same three talking heads. Once you hear the fake news quote, you're like, okay, here we go. Here's the guy who thinks I'm fake news. You're listening to the MSM. I'm like, oh, cool. There's the MSM guy. Okay, where's the lady talking about killing babies? Oh, there's the lady talking about killing babies. Everyone showed up on time. When your argument's not based in facts or any kind of science, there's no point in arguing. It's just kind of like, okay, let me just go ahead and nod, and I'm going to roll over here and keep talking about important things while the children argue in the corners.
Now that we have touched on that, and that is very helpful, it does give me peace in my heart too, where it's like, okay, let bygones be bygones. You know what I'm saying? How do you then go forth and decompress? Because right now for me, I'm overwhelmed. Every single day I wake up and I see something that catches my attention in the news. And then I end up digging myself even further because I'm like, okay, I have this responsibility in knowing what is going on right now, what is happening in current events. I need to be brushed up on this. But I allowed it to get to the point where I have gotten almost defensive and irritable and aggressive. I remember having like an argument with my girlfriend and she's like, what is going on with you? You're getting like really aggressive lately. I'm like, what? What are you talking about? Maybe it's because I'm from New York. And I just went off, like things I normally don't say. Any little thing, I usually just breeze through them with a go-getter, this is awesome kind of attitude. This time I'm like, oh, hell no. Da-da-da-da-da. I had to step back and, no joke, look up YouTube videos of corgi butts shaking and twerking. And I'm just like, oh my God, that is the cutest thing. So silly things like that. But for me, that works. But what about for you? How do you decompress? I'm sure it's not by dogs.
I actually have a dog. I love dogs.
Oh my God, you do? What kind?
Yes, I have an Australian Shepherd mix. So he's just a big, hairy, always there. He like lays on your feet. He always wants to be right next to you.
And he knows he's handsome, doesn't he?
Oh yeah, of course. And we go outside and he'll fetch and we'll play around. And he's an awesome dog. But I think for me, I've had to start limiting my news, especially we get everything so fast now. If you're on Twitter, you can get 6 different news stories in like an hour. I kind of just give myself like that 15 minutes in the morning to check out what's going on, and then 15 minutes in the evening before dinner. Yeah. And then that's about all I do. Like, other than that, it's just about finding things I like or reading a book. I don't watch a lot of TV unless I only watch it when I'm on the treadmill. And so if I'm avoiding the treadmill, then I'm not watching TV. But I do think you have to figure out what your tolerance is and limit it, because you can only fight so many battles. And when you're fighting on 40 different fronts, you're going to get tired very quickly.
I know. We got quite a few more years to go. So we got to preserve it.
Started. I call my senators and my representatives every day. I'll go to lunch at lunchtime, pick up the phone, and I'll call Pat Toomey's office. And I'm like, you know, whatever I'm objecting to that day. And then usually Senator Casey, I call his office and thank him for whatever he objected to that I am also objecting to. He's the liberal in our state. There's always state issues right now that we have to worry about as well. So I'll call my local state representatives. They're usually not helpful at all, but at least I call. They're voting on that. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, this is your office. I figure, okay, that's what I did for the day. And then if it's payday and I have a few extra dollars in my checking account, I'll give money to the ACLU. I figure out the things that I can impact and the things I can do. And sometimes those things that you can do is just writing a story that addresses the stuff that's going on. Sometimes the only thing you can do is create art that speaks out against the injustice in the world. It sucks, because if you want to do more, you want to jump on your dragon and burn the world to the ground.
You just Paula Khaleesi from Game of Thrones. Right? Yes, please.
Literally would love to do that, but I can't, right? So all I can do is look at the piece of the world I can impact. So what can I do? I can teach my daughter how to be a good person and tell her that the people who don't look like her matter just as much as she does. I can direct my money to charities that are going to help do that work when I can. Like, I can write art that addresses the injustices in the world and makes them digestible for people who may not necessarily want to hear that message. Twitter, and I can talk to the other people who are feeling the same way and offer encouragement and a little bit of fire so that their home fires can keep burning. And that's literally all I do. And then when I'm tired and I can't do that anymore, I go play Pokemon, because you cannot be upset when you have a Pikachu.
You can't. It's like having a dog.
Right. They're the best. It's really about understanding. I think a lot of people don't take the time to figure out what they need. We spend a lot of our time trying to figure out what other people around us need, but it's really important to understand what you need as well. To be able to stand up for those things. If I needed some more time on a project, I would feel very comfortable going to my editors and saying, I need more time. I cannot do this. That's what I need. Hope people start are surrounding themselves with people who understand those needs and are willing to help. Because I think a lot of times, especially in publishing, people get stuck into relationships with editors and maybe agents, not really a give and take. They're giving a lot more than they're getting in return. And I think that's how a lot of folks burn out. For me, I made a very conscious effort very early on that I only wanted to work with people who share my values and understand how important like things like diversity and equality and equity are. And so every time I make a decision about my career, I'm like, okay, how does this play back to my larger goal of equal access and equal stories for everyone and just getting those unheard voices to the table? I think as long as like you understand what you need and what you're like how you're talking about your grandfather, what's your passion? What's the thing that's going to help you get out of bed every morning? It's not going to be the treadmill.
That helps me stay in bed. Talking about diversity, I do know that a lot of our listeners want to write diverse characters or already writing diverse characters. Of course, all of them have very good intentions, but also there are those even starting out with good intentions, it's not going to be received. I'm not saying there's going to be negative backlash on the writing, not at all. It's more so I've come across authors who have been published saying that they had good intentions, absolutely from a point of ignorance, and they get a lot of backlash and they never meant it that way. So I'm worried for my listeners who are either already writing or about to write these stories and these characters. I ran across your article, which I loved, your blog post about how not to be an asshole when writing diverse characters. I love it. I'd love to link that on your show notes page for those who are driving the cars, either showering or whatever. I'd love for them to just hear this out. And can we talk a bit about how you'd advise to best go about writing diverse characters so that it's not lazy? It honors the people that they're writing about.
The first thing you have to do is you have to read people who don't look like you. If you're going to write a book with a Black main character and you are not a Black person, you should have read at least 20 or 30 books by Black authors with Black main character. How do people speak about themselves? My biggest pet peeves when you go to writing conferences or you hear these interviews from authors or the authors who say, I don't read. I don't read other people's books. I don't read. I'm like, you cannot write if you do not read, because you're going to fail. Because all you have then are the voices in your head. And the voices in your head are going to have your biases, your inherent blind spots to other cultures. You need to get the voices of others in your head. You need to be able to understand. If I'm talking to somebody and they say, yes, I want to write a Black main character, so I read The Help, I'm going to cringe and I'm going to be like, you're already messed up. You're already on the wrong spot, on the wrong foot. You can't save yourself from it at this point. You need to look. You need to also read critique by Black people. That's the culture you want to write thing. Jamie Go writes often about the fetishization of Asian cultures within fantasy and science fiction. If you're going to write an Asian-based fantasy, you should probably read about that and you should understand what that looks like, because if you understand what that looks like, you're less likely to put it into your stories and on your page. The first thing you have to do is you have to be able to open yourself up to the world and read those perspectives of people who don't look like you. And then you sit down and you write. Everything everybody writes that first time is freaking awful. The people who are like, I beat Nano and then I got an agent, those are unicorns. Those don't exist in the real world. Most stories take revision. It takes time. It takes distance. It takes a lot of work to make a story. So why would it be any different if you're writing outside your cultural lens? You should know that you're going to have to revise that. And so when you put it out there and someone says, hey, this isn't great, and this is why it isn't great, you need to be willing to listen to that and put aside your own feelings. I know a lot of people are like, well, I'm not racist, but we kind of all are. We all come into situations and make snap judgments on people based on how they look. That's how our brains are wired. The difference between being an unwilling racist or an active racist is just how much work you put into it. If you're like, I make snap judgments and I'm okay with that, that's a little more racist than, oh, I thought these problematic things, but I just didn't correct them. What you need to be willing to do is make those corrections. You need to be willing to look at the stuff you wrote and say, oh, you know, my reader said that this is really offensive and I don't understand how it's offensive, but I'm going to go research it and read up on it. Because that's the thing. It's like with the internet, no one has an excuse to be ignorant anymore. You find the answers to just about everything. I was just trying to update my iOS on Apple and I was like, why is this not updating? And I Googled it and I got 20,000 answers from just Apple. But like, if you know, why is a magical Negro character offensive? Google it and you'll get an answer. And then you'll understand what you're doing in the story within the page. And I think that's really what it's about. It's about looking at those stereotypes that you've brought into a story and figuring out how to dismantle them. Sometimes you're just not ready to write that story. Dread Nation is a great example. I started writing that years ago. It was just never worked for various reasons. My characters were flat. The story was stupid. It was just like, you know, there was a lot of reasons it didn't work. And sometimes your inauthentic character from a marginalized background is why the story doesn't work. It just means you're not ready to write that story and you should write something else. And the biggest part of it is if someone tells you you did something wrong, and you get called out for it, don't argue. It's a critique. If someone says your romance was flat and I didn't believe they were in love, that's just as much a critique as if someone says, hey, this character was kind of a racist stereotype and I wish they would have actually done a little bit more work to get that right.
You know, absolutely.
Like, just accept that critique and move on. And if you get a chance to rewrite a book with the continent, that's awesome. A lot of publishers will not postpone publication dates, even if a book is problematic, because they know it's going to sell anyway. That's the biggest thing. You may have written a terrible story, and it might be of racist stereotypes and slightly homophobic. It's still going to sell. That's the norm. That's not exceptional, having a book that has terrible stereotypes and slightly offensive. That's where we are at the playing field. The exceptional ones are the ones that do it well. Those are the ones that exist outside of the mainstreams. So I think as long as you're like writing with that savage empathy, realizing that you're probably going to get something wrong and being willing to be humble about it and correct it when it happens, you're 85% of the way there.
This is a bit of an interesting topic to bring up, where there are those who want to be our ally with all good intentions and they want to do the research and whatnot. But then there's some authors, some writers who believe that it's just not their place to write about a character, for example, that's Asian or Black if they're white, and to leave those for someone who truly is either Asian or Black because they really know their quote-unquote own stories.
Mm-hmm.
What's your take on that?
One of the great things about the United States is you can write whatever you want. For now.
Yeah.
I mean,
until it changes.
For now. I don't tell anybody this is what they should write, this is what they shouldn't write. I would caution anyone against writing an identity story of an identity they don't have. I would not write a story of a trans woman because I am not trans. I feel that's best left to folks who have that identity, who've gone through that transition, who have a close, intimate feeling with it that is like. However, I would feel very comfortable writing a secondary character who's trans. I think folks get wrapped up around this idea of, well, I have to write diversity, so I have to make my main character a Black woman. If you just look at the normal book, you can just make a secondary character Black, and you already did a great job of the diversity. I think there's a whole idea of the white man's burden and the white saviorism where they're like, if I don't fix it, nobody else will. But that's not true. You know, Black people are writing stories too. Chinese women are writing stories too. You can go and find that authentic identity story somewhere someone is writing it. However, if you want to make your main character Chinese because it's like my children are half Chinese, I spend a lot of time immersed in the culture, go ahead and do that if you feel strong about that. However, you still need to get someone to read it who's not your family. I've had this conversation with other Asian writers, and they're like, yeah, being part of the diaspora is hard because if you write a Korean fantasy, people who are more recently from Korea will tell you, you got it wrong. Like, you messed it up. And like, now our culture looks bad. That's their identity too. People of color are not a monolith or something. I think you should write whatever you want. However, you have to understand that people have the right to critique on it however they want as well.
And coming from acting, it was almost like a different culture back then because you barely heard of any auditions for Asian Americans. Why do we always have to be the sidekick? Why do we always have to be the best friend? So our language was more so, why do we always have to be the secondary characters? There were barely any Asian American storytellers to even write those scripts for us to go in for that. It became almost expected that it was a white person writing our stories. There were many actors who felt, well, I'd rather have a main character than no character that's Asian, or a main character than a secondary because I'm sick and tired of playing the best friend. I'm tired of playing that objectified woman. So it's to the point where we'll get whatever position that we have. And then from there, we almost have to prove our place to then be able to speak up. Then coming from a writer's point of view, I'm like, well, then that's our responsibility to step up and step in to create more of these stories of our own people. But then there have been people. It just hasn't been accepted.
I think Hollywood has been better at putting Asian folks and Latinos and Black folks in those secondary roles for a really long time, but never as the main character. But when you look over at publishing, like, we don't even get those secondary roles a lot of times, right? It is 100% all white cast in those stories. I do think if someone's going to do it respectfully and they're going to do it right, they should feel empowered to do that. However, if you're going to half-ass it, don't even try. It is harder to learn things now because everyone learns things in a very public forum. Like I say all the time, like a Twitter drag or like a public embarrassment is not life-threatening. You can come back from that. And a lot of people have.
I really appreciate that we had this conversation because I think, especially with everything that's been happening, I was like, what can I do in my own way that's true to my art form, my passion, but also where I'm not going to lose my damn mind and I'm not going to also lose fire because I'm going to have to preserve that and keep it correct. Going.
And I think that answer is always changing, right? Like, what can I do? Where am I best served? I think that's the meaning of life, is learning and growing and becoming better than we were yesterday. I think the people we have to be now is not the same people we had to be 4 years ago across the board. As long as we're trying to figure out the best path for ourselves, I think we're doing great. I think we're living our lives and hopefully bettering the world.
Now, because thanks to technology, people are showing their true colors. So it's like, oh my gosh, have we even made change? It gets to a point where sometimes I just feel hopeless. How much more time is needed to make it feel it's quote unquote back to normal again, if there was even a normal in the first place?
I think a lot of those folks, like, they've always thought that, right? It's just now that they're vocalizing out loud, which is great because you can't fix a problem if you don't know it's a problem. So now that you know your neighbor's racist, you're like, cool, now I can be ready for the shit that he's going to pull. A lot of people are overwhelmed because people are showing their true colors and their true thoughts. That, for me, I think is actually better because then you know who's truly on your side and who was just kind of being quiet because it wasn't acceptable. And I think it's nice to know where people stand. I think the biggest issue is going to be the people who are just apathetic, who just don't care one way or the other. Trying to get them to see how this is going to impact them directly, if authoritarianism is the way of the day, I think that's going to be the harder fight.
I'd love to swing it back to your stories. I know there's a lot of listeners who really loved Promise of Shadows. Could you give the snapshot?
It's Greek mythology based around the idea, what if everything you've ever been told about your life is a lie? Our main character is Zephyr Morning, and she's a harpy. She's accidentally killed a low-level god with this dark power that she has. And she's been told her entire life that it's a really bad thing that she has this power and she has to hide it and not use it. And then, you know, she kind of finds out that this power is what helps keep the balance of the higher gods. And of course, she's a prophecy because everyone loves a chosen one narrative. But then she's reluctant. She doesn't really want to take on this destiny of hers because she just wants to live a normal life. Greek mythology was the rage in YA about 5 years. I think it's a little darker. The romance is not main thrust of the story. It's kind of a secondary storyline. Like I said, I'm terrible at writing romance. I really like kissing, so it's like I gotta find a way to work a kissing scene in there. If you like Greek mythology and you're looking to see a new interpretation of it, I think the story will appeal to you. If you don't like Greek mythology, don't read it because you're just going to be miserable for 365 pages.
Amazing. I'd love to find out a bit about how your story process begins. Do you start with world building themes, a specific character as an inspiration, and goes from there?
I tend to write the opening scene very quickly, usually about the first 20,000, 25,000 words. That's when you kind of hit that going into the second act. That's when you set your hero up on their journey and they're going off to accomplish whatever they're going to accomplish. And then I usually take a break from there and I write the end because that's the place I want my hero to get to. And then I go back and I fill in all that stuff in the middle. I am not a linear writer. I think a lot of people are. They sit down, they write beginning to end. I'm not an outliner. I don't outline either. And a lot of my world building tends to be after the first draft. I'll write the first draft and then I come back and I will fill in those gaps. My world building tends to happen in layers. And my first drafts also tend to lack a lot of emotion. It's mostly a character reacting to the story, going through the story. And then when I come back for a second draft, I add in more of that emotional arc and that character arc. My drafting process is a mess. I know there's going to be at least 4 drafts before it's going to be anything worth reading. And I'm okay with that because I like that exploration of discovering the story. I've tried outlining. It doesn't work for me. I hate trying to figure out where the story is going if I'm not in the story. Once I have that ending and trying to connect those pieces, I'm usually pretty good.
Nice. Okay, so now, do you remember a very difficult scene that you came across, and how did you get through that?
Those scenes tend to be the ones that I feel closest to. Those are the ones that tend to echo something happening in my own life.
Yes.
And so I tend to write them, and I tend to write them very flat, moving my characters basically around the story. And then I come back later, and then I put the emotion in. There's a scene in Dread Nation, there's a couple of scenes where you're finding out more about her mother, who the main character, Jane, was raised on kind of a plantation. It's after the Emancipation Proclamation, but with a zombie plague, everything's very loosey-goosey and not very well governed. And so she kind of lives on this little plantation encampment with her mother, who is the owner of the plantations. She's biracial. She's half black and half white. There's this whole conversation about how she interacts with her mother. And it was really difficult to write because it's like, I'm also biracial. And I've had that same difficult conversation with my mother, trying to explain what it's like to be a black woman to your white mother. It's like, sometimes like you're talking to each other, but you're not connected. It gets very frustrating, especially when you're an adult and you're talking to your mother. She's remembering back to these different events that she's had with her mother. I had to just write the scene knew that was going to happen in the scene, and I knew it was going to be difficult for Jane, but like I wasn't really ready to take her there to that point of despair. So I just write it, and it's basically Mom and Jane are doing these things. Literary version of stick figures moving through a scene. And then I came back, colored in the stick figures, and I added some details. So like I ended up taking 4 or 5 times of going back to the scene. I wrote past the scene, then I came back and I worked on the scene, then I wrote past the scene again, then I came back and worked on the scene until it was finally where I wanted it to be. I think everybody has those difficult scenes. It's those ones that are closest to our own feelings or our own experiences, whether we understand that consciously or it's subconscious. And that's why it's difficult to get through that. And then once we get through it and we mapped a way for ourselves, I think it's easier to come back and make it shine.
Do you get to the point where you just have to stop? I know for me personally, when I have these very, very intimate moments with my characters and my scenes, because it is very much the reflection of my family life, I get very emotional. I have to step away, go for a walk. I have to put it away for a really long time. There was one time where I had nearly a year where I couldn't touch it. For you, is there a point where it gets to that point?
Definitely. I don't write the same thing necessarily every single day. I think a lot of folks do. I think they write one thing until it's done and they move to the next thing. I tend to have several projects going on. I contain multitudes. And so therefore, my writing should contain multitudes as well. Some days I'm going to write something funny. You know, I feel like crap today. Like, let's get this really shitty scene out of the way and like go write the shitty scene. I like to listen to music when I write, especially if it's a song that's really captures the feeling of the scene. I'll listen to that one song on repeat.
Is it Spotify that you use, or do you have your own iTunes collection?
I use Spotify. Sometimes when you don't want to write, it's really a great time waster to go build a playlist for a book. I don't do Pinterest. I know a lot of my friends do Pinterest boards for their books. So I just do playlists on Spotify. It's a great way to waste time. I listen to the pop music right now. It's like all Chainsmokers and Ariana Grande. I use that when I'm writing work for hire, because the work for hire tends to vary for younger kids and it tends to be very fast paced. When I'm writing my YA books, especially where the emotion's a little deeper and it's more introspective, there's a couple like shoegazing emo, Sunny Day Real Estate and Mineral.
So Tia Bearden, she had one more question for you. Tia mentioned that you just announced that you have a new agent, and she would love to know what that process has been like, swapping from one agent to another.
I think a lot of people have this idea that they get an agent and that agent is their agent forever. Like you get married and it's monogamy and that's the only person you're ever going to get married to. Amy Boggs was my agent. She's leaving agenting. She went to go take a position somewhere else in publishing, which happens a lot. Being an agent's a hustle. After a while, you just get tired of hustling. And so my contract is with Donald Mass Literary Agency. That's my literary agency. So there were other agents at the agency who were like, hey, I'll take on Justina. She's a fun train wreck, so I'd love to like have her in my life. And I ended up signing with Caitlin. It was really simple. It was like I talked on the phone to my agent when she told me she was leaving. And so I was like, oh gosh, I'm disappointed, because I was. I think she's a fabulous agent. Then she was like, okay, so I had a conversation with the other agents at the agency with Caitlin. Her vision kind of matches mine for my career. Again, back to that having a passion, and my passion is increasing the representation, the spaces at the table in publishing. Like, I know people were like, oh my God, Justina left her agent. No, it's like not like, you know, Amy goes, you're a mess. I can't deal with you anymore. I fired you. Nothing is salacious at all. It's literally just Amy's, I'm tired. I'm going to go do something else. I'm like, cool story, bro. I'll see you later. She's the best. We're so friendly and everything else. She's my third agent. My first agent had a baby, and then she decided she wanted to do mom stuff instead, which can totally get that. My second agent, she's still agenting. We just kind of weren't a good fit anymore because the things that she's interested in weren't the things that I was writing. So we got our separate ways. You're going to have lots of agents at different points in your career because your career is going to take a different path. I am not the same writer I was when my first book came out in 2013. I'm not the same writer I was when I first got an agent in 2009 or 10 or whatever. You're going to grow as a person. Your writing's going to grow, and you're going to need an agent that's going to grow with, who's going to fit when you change.
I do like that you mentioned that you're not the same writer as you were 2 years ago, 3 years ago. How do you think you've evolved creatively from when you first started your first novel?
I'm a much better writer than I was when my first book came out. My first book's a mess. I read it and I'm like, oh, Justina, what were you doing? I think also I'm less afraid to take on those deep, heavy issues than I was when I first started writing. When you first start writing, you just want someone to like your work. You just want someone to notice you. I don't care. They can hate it. I don't care. It's an amazing story. I'm going to write it how I want to write it. Confidence is also part of it, I think. When something doesn't go right, I know how to fix it. And I know I know how to fix it. So I'm less afraid to touch big things. A lot of it is dealing with heavy issues of identity and race and equity. I'm not afraid to talk about those things like I was before. I think that's why I always feel bad when I meet authors, especially younger authors who are new to publication, and they're like, you know, I saw this, it was bad, and I wanted to speak out, but I didn't. That's okay. You understood it was bad, and you wanted to speak out, and you weren't brave enough. Maybe next time you'll feel a little braver, and you'll be willing to speak out about it. I think everyone has to grow as a person. I'm comfortable pointing out books, even by very popular authors, and saying, like, this is a problem. I wasn't 5 years ago. I think we should all be growing and changing as people. And whatever that means for each of us should be different. For me, it just means I can look at those big ideas and those big issues, and I'm not afraid to have an opinion on them.
I love that. I'm going to wrap it up with rapid fire questions, and you can answer as short as you want and however you want. Tips on query letters.
You have to figure out who you're querying, first of all, before you even write the letter, because you need to know what kind of stuff exists out there and who's already out. So I always recommend researching agents before you write your query letter. When you're writing a query letter, who your main character is, what they want, what's at stake, what happens if they don't get it. Those are literally the only things you have to have in a querying letter. My name is Jane and I live in the South. And I want to be homecoming queen. If I don't become homecoming queen, then I'm going to have low self-esteem and I'm going to cry. So what's in my way from becoming homecoming queen? And then what am I going to do to get it? I think there's a lot of great resources out there for query letters. I think query letters are the least of your problem. I think you need to make sure you have a great manuscript, because it doesn't matter how awesome your query letter is. If your manuscript is balls, you're not going to do it. That's not going to matter. I think a lot of agents request those first five pages for a reason. I know Amy, we had this conversation before, and she barely would read the query letter. She only used it to kind of get an idea of where she was going. It was the pages that made or break whether she requested. Especially if an agent asks for pages, focus on making sure those pages are not a mess. It doesn't matter how great your query letter is. If your book is a mess, you're not going to get anywhere.
That's very helpful. Thank you for that. And now, second question, money. A lot of writers, a lot of artists overall are struggling with money. How did you go about earning income? What's your recommendation? Do you have any resources to point at or any stories to share?
I have a day job because I'm a strong believer that you need to have a job that's going to pay for you to eat so it doesn't impact your art. I will not ever be a full-time author unless my book makes a kajillion dollars and there's movies and stuff, and then I'll be a full-time author. You cannot live off of your art, because you're going to starve your creative soul trying to make a buck and trying to feed your physical self. I always recommend when folks are in college or just starting out on their career path, find a job that you can do that you don't hate. Don't go do something that makes you want to murder someone every day. Find a job that you're like, this job pays for me to have health insurance. This job pays for me to have a safe place to live, because that's going to give you the space to create. I do work for hire because I enjoy doing work for hire. And I did that through Capstone. And I think they have an application process on their website that folks can look at. I do that because I enjoy doing it, not because I have to do it to work, to eat. All my bills and everything is paid for by my day job. I recommend strongly that folks, if they can have a day job, have a day job. If they don't have a day job, or if they're unable to, then I do think there are a lot of stuff, places you can look for freelancing. I think more and more nowadays, people are expecting more for less when you're looking at freelancing stuff. So I also think that's not necessarily a great way to feed yourself if you have an option to do something else. I know folks who teach writing courses, if they have MFAs or if they do something like that. But again, just keep in mind, when you're using that creative part of your life to earn money as your labor, it can impact your own work.
That's really helpful. Third and final rapid question. What are small, manageable steps you'd advise writers to take every week towards accomplishing their writing goals?
If you can write 500 words every day, at the end of the month, you'll have 15,000 words. I try to write 1,000 words every day. I feel 1,000 words is about what I can write in an hour. So an hour is about my attention span. It's usually closer to 45, 50 minutes. I write 1,000 words every day. At the end of the month, I have 30,000 words. At the end of 2 months, I have almost a full draft or a full book. After I've gotten through like the first 60,000 words of a book, I tend to pick up momentum and write last third a lot faster. I just recommend just write a little bit every day. And if you don't want to write every day, just write a little bit when you can write. People get into these ridiculous word counts, like, I'm going to write 10,000 words today. I'm like, that's great if you can write 10,000 words and don't feel a wrung out dishcloth at the end. Eventually, you'll have a story and you'll have something you love. And I also recommend people keep going forward. Don't keep going back. I know sometimes people get into this trap of, like, they'll sit down and every time they write, they want to go back to chapter one and start revising. It's like, no. Keep going forward. And then you can come back and revise after you have a complete draft.
Justina, you've been awesome. Thank you so much.
This is fun.
And that wraps up our episode with the amazing Justina Ireland. Justina, thank you so much for being so present and intentional throughout our discussion. I had a really great time with you. Storytellers, thank you for listening in and joining us as always. I hope you enjoyed Justina's episode and took a lot from it. Please say hi to Justina on Twitter at Justina Ireland. She recommended a lot of books and resources for you to check out, and we have them all linked up in our show notes page over at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Justina Ireland.
At the very top of the show, I mentioned Vermont College of Fine Arts. I know there's a lot of you who are really interested in writing books for children or young adults, so you'll definitely want to pay special attention to what Vermont College of Fine Arts has to offer. VCFA has three different graduate level programs for writers, and I'll be going into detail about their program called Writing for Children and Young Adults. Students meet up twice a year on their gorgeous campus in the heart of historic Montpelier in Vermont for intensive 10-day residencies. It's a lot like 10-day retreats for writers, and you guys know how much I love retreats. So imagine attending VCFA's MFA program where you'll be immersed in an amazing writing community, filled with intensive workshops, lectures, panel discussions, and readings that are always challenging and inspiring you. After the life-changing experiences at the residencies, you and the faculty will design your own course for the start of the semester by really zoning in on your specific writing goals. Throughout the semester, you'll continue working with faculty mentors through telephone conferences, emails, and letters. So basically, you're receiving one-on-one mentorship throughout your semester as you take control in shaping the kind of education you want out of your time with VCFA. Check out 88cupsoftea.com/VCFA for more info. Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye!